Aside from sometimes popping up as a topic, for example, in relation to plastics, oil spills, or occasional references to melting glaciers, the oceans are often a forgotten space for many otherwise inspiring social movements. But the oceans have had a central and changing role across different moments. The global ocean has through the centuries served as a trade route, strategic space, fish bank, and supply chain for the modern capitalist economy. While seabeds are drilled for their fossil fuels and minerals, and coastlines developed for real estate and leisure, the oceans continue to absorb the toxic discharges of our carbon civilization, warming, expanding, and acidifying the blue water part of the planet in ways that will bring unpredictable but irreversible consequences for the rest of the biosphere. Here at the State of Power podcast, we're concerned with the ways in which power functions, both on land and on the sea. With the United Nations Oceans Conference coming up between 25 June and 1 July this year, we thought this would be as good a time as any to take a closer look at the oceans that make up more than 70% of our planet's surface. What is the relation between contemporary social, environmental, climate, economic crises and the oceans? Also, who's benefiting from all this exploitation of the oceans and how? Who are the capitalists at sea? And what are their strategies? What types of acts of resistance and struggle exist against these interests, historically and today? Our guests on the podcast today, Liam Kempling and Alex Kolas, are the authors of the book Capitalism and the Sea, The Maritime Factor in the Making of the Modern World. In their book, which deals with the political economy, ecology, and geopolitics of the sea, the authors argue that the Earth's geographical separation into land and sea has significant consequences for capitalist development. They show how capitalism aims to transcend the land-sea binary in an incessant quest for profit. What follows is their conversation with your host today, Mads Babeskard, who is a researcher with TNI, working on struggles around the use and control of land and ocean resources in the midst of the energy transition. Mads is also a senior lecturer at the Department of Human Geography at Lund University in Sweden. Mads began by asking our guests why we should care about the oceans, if at all.
So, why do or should perhaps the oceans matter for people concerned with already fighting against inequalities and oppressions in our contemporary society? Why does the ocean matter?
I suppose what is in the forefront of most people's minds when they think about the ocean are crises of biodiversity, like overfishing, or other problems like marine litter, especially around plastics. And these are kind of crucial issues, but they're not the big ones. The big ones that are going to affect all of humanity, albeit in highly uneven and differentiated ways, depending upon where you live and how relatively wealthy you are the triple crises of ocean acidification, heating, and dead zones. And so ocean acidification is kind of climate change's evil twin. Essentially, what it involves is ever more kind of carbon being absorbed in the ocean, making the ocean more carbonific, which makes it increasingly difficult for the critters that live at the bottom of the food web, phytoplankton and so on, to grow their tiny little shells. I mean, we can't really see them very well with the naked eye, but if you zoom in on phytoplankton, they're an incredible wide range of species. And they have shells and they have kind of bodies that are based upon the formation of calcium, which with ocean acidification essentially eats them away. And they are the basis for the entire food web for all of the ocean. And of course, including ultimately humans. One of the other big questions is sea temperatures. And this is something that people know a bit more about, I think. And so we're all aware that kind of global warming, we're also all aware of that heating includes heating of the ocean. But what perhaps we're less aware of is just how deep that goes. So the greatest depths of the ocean are storing kind of the heat of our production of energy and activity, largely industry, but also kind of home heating and so on. And so gradually the oceans are heating up. And so even if we can hold global air temperatures to, you know, ideally 1.5 degrees Celsius, of course, still that's dangerous for many people around the world, sea temperatures will rise by at least 2 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. The future is in the present here. The oceans are an already existing kind of imprint of our activities over the last few hundred years. And the other thing I've mentioned is the dead zones. And this is essentially areas where fish and other marine animals can no longer live because they've been deoxygenated. And so you have entire areas of the ocean where a species can no longer live in places where they used to live or have evolved to live in over millions of years. And so they're the three kind of big kind of environmental or oceanographic kind of dynamics, I think, that are facing the human species as a whole.
If I can just add to this, Matt, so Liam's been focusing rightly on the way in which the oceans absorb this carbon surplus that anthropogenic capitalist scene, whatever you want to call it, emits. But of course, there's a lot of life, human life at sea. And one of the characteristics of the 7/10 of the world that the oceans cover is the sort of obfuscation, the hiding away of all kinds of very powerful social relations that either in the obvious cases of transport circulate 90% of everything, and I'm sure we'll come back to that in the conversation, or perhaps more importantly for maybe the audience of this kind of podcast, provide protein for many billions across the world and livelihoods for many other millions. So I think the oceans are important because they're we're killing them, but they're also a very important source of livelihood. They are simultaneously a threat, particularly as we know for populations living in low coastal areas or in small island states, at the same time as they're incredibly important for the social reproduction of whole populations, particularly in the global south. I couldn't resist bringing in a very topical headline that was covered in the British press, which was the going dark of several billionaire super yachts over the past few months as a result of the conflict in Ukraine. So as billionaires across the world love to have, for some reason, they're fixated with yachts. Our own one in Britain is Branson, Richard Branson, who not only has yachts, but his own island, of course. He owns his own island in the Caribbean and indeed has, as we may know, a company called Virgin. So there's a whole sort of masculinist fantasy around the virginity, the sort of properties of these territories that are outside of society. They're almost like utopias. And the yachts that sail around the world supposedly unobserved a part of that, but as a result of the war in the Ukraine, many Russian oligarchs have had their yachts impounded in various parts of the world, in Trieste. In fact, in the book, in our book on Capitalism the Sea, we talk about one of these oligarchs, a guy called Melnichenko, who's got, I think he's got a world-beating 143-meter sailing yacht, and that was impounded recently, but many others are still circulating across the world and literally gone dark, have gone out of the radar. And I think that's a very nice metaphor for two things. One is the deep inequalities that are reproduced at sea, the social lives that are lived at sea. No doubt we'll talk about the labor and the workers that are super exploited and generally face especially hazardous and super exploitative conditions at sea, but that's simultaneously lived by a small minority, even less than the 1%, that fetishize the oceans and the vessels that carry them around. So that on the one hand, the deep inequalities, and secondly, the obfuscation that I was referring to. The sea is, contra what is often presented, is not an unregulated space. There are plenty of laws at sea, and in some respects, the modern international law was invented at sea or through concepts like the freedom of navigation. So it's not a forgotten space in the sense of it being or certainly even less so, a wild space that is without law, quite the opposite. The point is the enforcement and the unequal enforcement of those laws. And furthermore, the fact that there's a constant reinvention of ways in which to hide wealth and to hide from public scrutiny. And I return back to this idea of the offshore financial centers being intimately connected to ocean-faring entrepreneurs right from the beginning. And in the 21st century version, they are the Richard Bransons and the Andrei Melnichenkos and many others who, as I say, somehow, and I think it has to do with this notion of a neoliberal utopia where we call it a sort of oceanic sublime in our book, the sense that the oceans are beyond the control of political forces, that they provide an isolation from the hoi polloi, the everyday humdrum class politics of the societies where this wealth is created. So I just wanted to throw that in as another reason why we should be looking at the oceans, because they actually reflect back on our society as deeply unequal and deeply distorted society, almost in an ideological sense.
Thanks for those points. I like that phrase you used, Alex, about how it kind of the obfuscation of powerful social relations. And so picking up also on what you alluded to here about sort of the historical role of the oceans and the role that they have played in forming law, as you were alluding to here, I also know that you've both looked a lot at how the sea has been important over time for capital and indeed for capitalism's historical development, right? And so I would like to hear a bit about, now that you've given this overview of sort of why we should care now, if you could elaborate a bit on how did we get here, right? And so, you know, and kind of contrasting to the maybe typical explanation that we hear around contemporary ocean dynamics, where there's a real tendency to focus maybe on the post-World War II period and more sort of recent decades technological development, along with the implications of individual consumption patterns, as we saw, for example, in the kind of famous Netflix documentary Seaspiracy. But already from what you're saying here, it seems like there's a deeper story or history to uncover.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first thing to say is that there's no capitalist accumulation in the way that we understand it without seaborne trade. And of course, there's been seaborne trade throughout the centuries. Many civilizations have had very rich histories of oceanic transactions. But what happened sometime in the period of the long 16th century, you know, roughly from the late 1400s till the early 1600s, is that there's a concentration of merchant capital that is a way of basically buying cheap and selling dear in the northeastern parts of the European continent, in places like Antwerp and then Amsterdam, and then obviously London. And this, if I can use the Marxist categories in this context, is very much the process of primitive accumulation. That is a process that certainly happens within those societies where, as we know, land and labor is effectively privatized or is alienated to private property. And there's the sort of agrarian origins of capitalism, but they face seaward, and without the possibilities of exporting and importing commodities, the consolidation of that primitive accumulation, I think, is unthinkable historically. Very important in that is the traffic in human beings. So the transformation to millions of enslaved Africans into a commodity that is tradable becomes central to the accumulation of capital in London. And just to be very specific about this, what we're talking about here in that early modern period, not just in London, by the way, but in other major cities of the European, Western European coastlines, is the development of finance, of credit, of an infrastructure that allows an investing public to put some of their sometimes hard-earned cash into an enterprise that might, for instance, involve buying privileges in the trafficking of human beings in the South Sea, just off, I guess, what is now the southern cone of Latin America. So the South Sea Company is one example of an 18th century enterprise that is only conceivable with an investing public, and that requires a whole set of interactions that are concentrated in cities like London. So the first thing to say really is that there is no capitalism without the sea, insofar as that merchandise, including human merchandise, is central to the accumulation of capital in Europe. Now, fast forwarding, you rightly talked about the distinction between perhaps the origins of capitalism, and there's, you know, big academic debates around that, versus the development of capitalist social relations, which are fundamentally about exploiting land and labor for the purposes of generating a surplus value. I mean, that's pretty much what capitalism does, and reinvesting that capital then in order to create more value and profits. The oceans have been a sort of laboratory for various legal forms. The exclusive economic zone is perhaps the most relevant one for our purposes in the discussion today, which emerges in the post-war period, but really as a result of complex interactions between newly independent states, or at least newly emerging economies in with distant fisheries or sometimes coastal fisheries like in the Pacific, Latin America. But it combines the notion of an exclusive economic zone with a much older understanding of freedom of navigation, freedom of the seas beyond a certain coastal gunshot. So originally, it was 12 nautical miles because it was alleged that that's as far as the cannon shot would get, and those are the limits of coastal waters. We're talking here about the 16th and 17th century, the codification of the idea that the seas are nobody's property and that they're basically there for the most powerful to navigate and exchange commodities. That principle, perhaps most powerfully reflected in the writings of Hugo Grotius, then reappears in unexpected forms. I don't think there's any sort of functional continuity here, but it reappears in the shape of the 200 nautical mile limit of the exclusive economic zone. If we think about flags of convenience, that's another example of where, again, the need to codify property at sea, who commands a vessel and what is in the vessel, including the labor power in that vessel, is determined by so-called open registries. So, as we know, a very common phenomenon in 20th century ocean world is a vessel that might have been built, I don't know, in Korea. It might be owned by a Danish or a Greek shipping magnate. It may be then the shipping might be conducted by Maersk, a Danish company. The labor in that vessel, particularly the ratings, might be Filipino or Vietnamese. The officers may be Ukrainian. The ship is flagged in Panama, and the goods that it's carrying are from Hamburg to New Jersey. So the international dimension of capital is inherent in that ship. And yet the question of who owns the property, both the labor power and then the commodities in that vessel and the vessel itself, is completely fragmented. And so I'd venture to say that the ocean world has been a domain of capitalist experimentation, or a laboratory for inventing new legal forms, new legal fictions that are very real, but allow for phenomena like, for instance, offshoring, literally, or for subcontracting of labor, or for labor arbitrage. Again, buying cheap and selling dear, or making the most of geographical distance to super exploit certain labor that for a variety of reasons has been racialized as being cheaper or more docile for the benefit of accumulation in another part of the world. So a bit of a long list there, Mats, but I hope it gives you an illustration of how, in all kinds of ways, the oceans have been really, as I was saying, a really important site for the development of legal, financial, labor forms that are important, not just to seafaring, but also important on land as well.
Yeah, thanks for that, Alex. Liam, maybe you can pick up a bit on this as well, but I would maybe like to hear a bit from you more explicitly, let's say, about the role of the state in these processes that Alex was getting at, right? So Alex was talking a bit about, for example, the invention of exclusive economic zones as a process of kind of states taking control over oceans. But maybe you could elaborate a bit on that, right? Why and how have states concretely sought to gain control over oceans? And maybe also a bit about what kinds of tensions do we see between states arising as a result of these processes?
Thanks, Mats. Yeah, I suppose one of the things to connect back to Alex's story just now is the role of the state also in creating the companies that were the advanced guard of European empires. And so, for example, the East India Company and, you know, being a chartered company, which, you know, was crucial to understanding the expansion of these kind of commercial empires, which then gradually developed over time into territorial imperialism. In those very early days of capitalism, the state has been central to kind of to trying to create some form of order in the ocean. But one of the main ways in which the state in Britain, in particular, tried to do that was to ensure safe passage of smooth circulation of commodities. And so, to some extent, there was a strong interpenetration of kind of state interests in the global ocean for maintaining that kind of relative stability of the ocean as this place of circulation. But it was also a process of insignificant inter-imperialist rivalry, of course, both on the land but in the sea. And so you had the, you know, states competing with each other to try and establish, for example, in the 19th century, steam liners. So Britain dominated the global kind of maritime trade, merchant shipping, controlled about 40% of all of the shipping vessels in the Victorian era, and the Germans provided mail subsidies to their shipping industry to try to take them on. The Japanese did the same, but the Japanese also then tried to use the ocean as this part of the broader process of oceanic accumulation, developing maritime industries around fishing, around shipbuilding, around trade. And part of those that expansive logic is actually quite significantly mirrored today in China. One of the major areas, to come back to this point of tension, is precisely the kind of the maritime reach and ambitions of China, and the strong desire by, you know, the US-led empire to keep China in its place. Now, part of this story can be traced back to the fact that China has a tiny exclusive economic zone. So that's the 200 nautical mile zone from its waters. And this isn't to justify Chinese kind of aggression, of course. It's just to try and explain it. And in the post-World War II kind of gradual emergence of the UN law of the sea, by the 1970s and customary international law, states had made claim to 200 nautical miles of oceanic space from their coastline out into the ocean. Of course, that creates all kind of tensions where you've got states that are close to each other. And what that exclusive economic zone provides for is sovereign rights over all of the marine life that live in that ocean, but also the capacity to extract resources from the subsoil, from the seabed. And so you can see how this kind of scramble for oceanic space becomes an oceanic scramble for resources. Now, compared to the United States, which had the confetti of empire, tiny islands dotted around the Pacific, which it laid claim to, same for France, Britain, and others, China had a very small exclusive economic zone. And so it has a very limited claim on the subsoil of the ocean, and it has a very limited claim on marine biodiversity. So, much like Japan, in the 1920s, China has been promoting the going out of its distant water fishing fleet into waters all around the world. It's now the largest distant water fishing fleet by a very large margin, and it has kind of thousands and thousands of ships kind of traversing the global ocean to extract fish. And crucially, very often this fish is not to be consumed in China. Much like Japan, again, it's about a project of creating onshore jobs for export-oriented production. So again, there's this kind of very strong relationship between land and sea. You know, there isn't some binary, right? They're always in articulation. And much like earlier on when we were talking about the kind of, you're alluding to the great acceleration, you know, most people, when they think of changes in kind of ocean dynamics, they think about the post-World War II period. But actually, it could be traced much further back to the kind of earlier period of industrial production, but even further back to the plantation scene, or the period of the expansion of plantations and what Gyrus Banerjee calls the produce trades, which were the advanced guard of empire across the planet. And so what made those empires possible was oceanic strategies. And so what China is doing now, and having facing off in the Pacific Islands at the moment against Australia, for example, is precisely mirroring this history that can be kind of told through the story of kind of the Western empires as well. Another quick thing is that one of the interesting things I think about a lot of the fishing industry is that if you look at where a lot of the distant water fishing nations are based, they're very often based in their former colonial territories. So that, you know, the French have strong ties with West Africa and the Western Indian Ocean. The Japanese historically had strong ties in the Pacific Islands, where they had relationships after World War II, after the Treaty of Versailles. And of course, the Americans, until the emergence of the exclusive economic zone, had strong ties in Latin America and were targeting those fisheries. But the exclusive economic zone had another kind of story. And this was the story of developmentalism, where coastal states, independent states, used exclusive economic zones to try to capture more benefits from foreign fishing fleets in their waters by charging them more rents. So the state was acting as a kind of landlord, or by trying to create a domestic fishery to process and catch that fish domestically for domestic consumption, but also for export. And so one of the big tensions that one faces even within countries, in a lot of developing countries today, is precisely that tension between the kind of export-oriented economy, the industrial kind of fishing activity, and the more artisanal and small-scale fishing. And of course, there's very different claims to food there. You know, the right to food through the right to work in a fish factory, and of course, the right to food through the right to be able to access intergenerational fish stocks around reefs and so on. And there are important conflicts around that kind of access.
Great. Thanks for those points. So until now, you've kind of covered, you know, the relation between the sea and the rise in consolidation, you could say expansion of capitalism historically. And just now we heard a bit about sort of the historical role of the state in that process. And of course, you opened up with this current context of different types of oceanic crises in the contemporary moment. So now I think I'd like to turn to ask, who is it that is benefiting from all of this and how? And so maybe you could get a bit into who are the capitalists at sea, right? So you've already touched a bit on this, at least historically, but what are the companies that are active out there today, and what are their strategies for profiting basically at sea?
I think that where I would start in thinking about who are the capitalists at sea is probably the logistics industry or maritime logistics. I mean, it's a giant industry. I mean, the shipping industry is worth, I think, something like $500 billion annually. And when we think about shipping, we're very often thinking about containers and containerization. And there's a good reason for that, because, of course, it's a great example of how the world economy is now organized, kind of fragmented across networks of global production, which, you know, put people and places in competition against each other in ways that were really not possible before. And what it also allows us to then start thinking about is the role of capitalist planning in shaping the world economy. You know, it's not like there's a singular capitalist out there, even Walmart, although, of course, Walmart does shape to a large extent significant volumes of export-oriented production in China and other locations. But this capitalist planning by big multinationals, both by lead firms who are buying space on ships, but also then by liner vessels like Maersk and others, are slicing up the global ocean into, well, essentially routes to shift commodities from A to B, or a widget from one place to another to be then transformed into an augmented widget or whatever it might be. And the way that big capitals try to deal with this is to become ever more concentrated. And so at the top, companies like Maersk and others have bought their competitors. And so they've engaged in mergers and acquisitions. And so you have a very small number of very powerful container shipping firms. But they took it a step further. And they've set up what are three global alliances. So each alliance is a kind of conglomeration of individual firms, and they cooperate together around sharing routes and lines in order to be able to offer a service that Walmart or whoever else or Procter & Gamble or whoever it is demands off of them. And so at the top here, there are, you know, significant profits. But there is also significant risk. And so you have some companies like Hanjin in the summer of 2016 collapsed. But one of the reasons why it collapsed is because it was in such incredible debt. About 60% of its fleet was owned by others. Now, unluckily for Hanjin, the South Korean state did not buy it out. But the South Korean state did buy out its competitor, the Hyundai Merchant Marine. What this little case kind of shows is that even in these industries that are kind of in the background, there some of them are too big to fail, or at least those that are favored by the state. And so if you then kind of keep that in mind at the top, you then start differentiating across the entire area of maritime logistics, and you have a whole world of diversity from roll-on, roll-offs, or ro-ros, transporting cars around the world, to specialized vessels shipping timber, to freezer reefer vessels selling, distributing kind of like things like frozen fish or frozen meats, all the way through, of course, to dry bulk, you know, shifting coal or new renewable ores, and of course, oil tankers. And each of these have their own segments and their own levels of differentiation according to who are the lead firms and who are kind of quite fragmented at the bottom. Because at the bottom of a lot of shipping, you have incredible levels of diversity of ownership and much more opportunism. And so even though the lead firms like Maersk, for example, might be pushing forward things like trying to make shipping less polluting, or perhaps reducing the climate impact of shipping. At the bottom, you have this whole chunk, this whole kind of world of shipping and highly small firms who, you know, that for them, that's light years away. They're trying to survive. They're in incredible competition with each other. It's highly opportunistic. And so you have a quite complicated world. And then the similar kind of story then comes out if you start thinking about fishing and different types of fishing firms, different species, different technologies to catch different types of fish, the different depths, different types of supply chains connecting all of those up. And so, you know, I could talk about this forever, but perhaps I'll just stop there.
Can I just, sorry, Mats, to quickly add a little coda, again, a very topical one, but the freight carriers, the shipping firms like Maersk or Costco, the Chinese shipping company, or indeed Germany's Hapag-Lloyd, you know, to name three of the big ones, have had a great pandemic. I mean, I think it shows how, notwithstanding Liam's points of constant competition and mergers and acquisitions, the pandemic reveals the structural power of this kind of capital. that like big pharma or like big entertainment, you know, has a captive audience. I mean, threefold reported pre-tax profits for Maersk, $24 billion in 2021 alone, $14 billion in pre-tax earnings for Costco, and $12.8 billion last year for Hapag-Lloyd. So, you know, it gives you a sense of how both the quantities that we're dealing with, but the fact that, you know, they don't let a good crisis go to waste.
Nicely put. So while the rest of us, or many of us, were locked up, they were profiting. So picking up on this point here, how you closed it, Alex, actually talking about the structural power of capital at sea, I would now like to turn to what types of kind of acts of resistance and struggle exist against this structural power of capital at sea, right? So we heard a bit about the role of the state and indeed about the different, yeah, capital, as you were talking about, but maybe we could get a bit now to labor, right? And how labor movements historically, as well as today, are in struggle with capital and state at sea.
Yeah. So it's a very rich history across different parts of the world, but it's a contradictory one. And I think that some of the key words are the contradiction between an internationalist disposition, sometimes because of the very nature of the labor as being about transport, about being moving from one jurisdiction to another in crews that are almost always polyglot, multi-faith, if any faith, multinational, and so on and so forth. So there's that quite, well, I think for us, I presume in this kind of call, attractive internationalism, but it coexists with the kinds of protectionism that Liam was referring to, and the chauvinistic nationalism, color lines, white supremacism. At different junctures, there's been all of that. I mean, I should start again with the fact that in the slave ships of the Atlantic, there would have been forms of labor that were in contradiction. So the very first industrial workers of the world, arguably, were seafarers who were transporting the bonds people from the African continent to the Americas as labor power. And whereas one form of labor in that ship had a contract, a relatively stable wage, some kind of freedom to engage in labor or not, the many other thousands who might have been, or hundreds in each vessel, and then millions throughout the long period of Atlantic slavery, were, of course, bonded for life as enslaved peoples. That notwithstanding, I think, as Marcus Rediker, Peter Linebaum, many other radical historians have demonstrated, there's always resistance. And, you know, be it from the enslaved peoples that mutiny or that rise against their masters, even within the ship, or conduct weapons, as it were, weapons of the weak, but conduct some kinds of sabotage or undermining the authority of those vessels, even if it is to maintain some degree of dignity and solidarity under those inhuman conditions, albeit those wage laborers themselves, who, as saying Marcus Rediker in his one of his first books on this subject, reminds us that the word in English, strike, maybe this is true of other languages of Northern Europe, refers to the action that London seafarers and dock workers took in striking down the sail in order to get better wages. So, you know, anecdotally, you could say that the maritime workers invented the notion of the strike as boycotting their own forces of production by way of getting better conditions for their own labor. Now, that tradition was consolidated with the advancement of industrial capitalism. And roughly speaking, there was a transition between what might have been a motley crew, as I was describing, of all hands on deck, on seafarers that had, in many cases, long experience at sea, that had multiple skills and would have had to do all kinds of things whilst on the vessel, from rigging through to cooking, through to on and offloading, And the transition from that world of sail to a more steam-powered, industrialized organization of the ship, as I say, this is a rough and ready contrast, where the labor force was much more segmented, much more specialized with the introduction of coal into steamships. You've got proletarians, laborers in the lower decks of the ship, coaling, stokers, their superiors would have been engineers. You've got the entrance for the first time of women into the workforce. I mean, obviously there's some women now particularly working on cruise ships, but until that time, and to a certain degree to this day, it's a very male-dominated workplace, but the kitchens, the provisions, the victualling, the sort of maintenance, the social reproduction of these vessels was much more segmented. And in some instances, what I was referring to earlier, the labor arbitrage, the hiring of so-called Lascars, that is generic, racialized seafarers, laborers from along all the coastlines of the Indian Ocean, but particularly from South Asia, become the manual labor that through a process of codification is paid less and has fewer rights to their white counterparts. So those are illustrations of how the beginning of a workforce in these coal ships, in these more segmented transport freight vessels, I'm not talking about fisheries, Liam might come in on here, starts to proletarianize, if you like, the labor composition. And that then has implications for labor unionism, because once more, as we saw, as we were saying earlier, the sea has been at vanguard of capitalist development in terms of capital, but it's also been a very important place for experimentation of labor. And the first national unions were certainly in places like the UK from the 1880s were seamen's unions, what eventually became the International Transport Workers Federation. The new unionism of the 1870s, not just in the UK, but in places in the following decades, like Australia or New Zealand, the settler colonies become foci of labor organization of the so-called new unionism. Once again, something that maybe we'll pick up right at the end, the trans-sector solidarity between dock workers and seafarers, and between dock workers and their immediate neighborhoods, the possibility of generating working class solidarities in actual neighborhoods that were maritime facing, that were often very cosmopolitan, a sort of saltwater cosmopolitanism of peoples of various different parts of the world, not always necessarily harmoniously, but necessarily living cheek by jowl and, you know, often reproducing, having children, and then the wonderful mix of multicultural mixes of places like Tiger Bay in Cardiff, or indeed parts of London like Limehouse, cannot be understood without that sort of labor interaction and of working class, seafaring working class neighborhoods that become really, really militant because they have that capacity of stoppage, both of labor, of withdrawing labor, but of course, stopping circulation. And so I would emphasize, therefore, the historical legacy of those kinds of internationalisms that is by no means unproblematic. I mean, it bears underlining that that international is constantly punctuated by its opposite, by racism and by supremacy and by national chauvinism, but that nonetheless then continues into the present day, where I think many of the same dilemmas, many of the same challenges of thinking across the sector, thinking across the supply chains, and those very sites of organization, be it warehouses, ports, or vessels, I think can learn a great deal from a very long history of sea-oriented labor solidarity.
Thanks for that, Alex. I think indeed we'll pick it up again in the end of the podcast or in the last question. But before we do that, I just wanted to follow up with this UN Ocean Conference that is going to be taking place in the end of June in Lisbon, in Portugal. And would like to kind of encourage both of you to, if you were to take on the perspective of capital at sea, right? So some of the companies you were talking about before. And so from this perspective, what do they want to happen at this conference, right? What type of new or changed ocean governance would they like to see as they are pursuing capital accumulation at sea?
So now I'm going to put my my corporate CEO hat on and my crystal ball. But so I think that one of the big things that big business, at least, would want from the UN Ocean Conference and the plethora of initiatives like it is technical fixes. Even though, of course, some multinationals are changing the way they do things, the vast majority are engaging in business as usual, and they are really hoping for technical fixes to problems like climate change and biodiversity loss through things such as spraying the oceans with reflective matter so as to be able to reflect sunlight back into space. Or, for example, you know, using Google Earth, fish watch kind of technologies to be able to track boats and therefore know what's happening and be able to solve problems, you know, as a computer or whatever. The problem with all of these approaches is they really very often are sometimes well-meaning, but rarely get to the real roots or symptoms of the problems. So, for example, the reason why there's a problem with climate is that because of the way that capitalism operates, which is to promote and to produce a system of ever-expanding consumption. And I don't see a great deal of multinationals, and they would be the main business people operating at the UN Ocean Conference, advocating radical reductions in consumption of their products. And so even though you may have individual enterprises, again, coming back to this kind of idea of the well-meaning CEO or corporate board, individual enterprises may well be engaging in some, you know, quite interesting kind of reforms. But when you scale that up to the collectivity of corporations that constitute the majority of the world economy, that well-meaningness essentially dissipates into the fundamental need to be able to compete or die as a corporate kind of entity. And so I think that that's a fundamental dynamic. A kind of a more specific dynamics that I think are important and really crucial to keep an eye on are, of course, things like deep sea mining. And deep sea mining is going to be a tricky one because on the one hand, you know, there is now, one could argue, recognition on a global scale that we need to shift our consumption away from, you know, internal combustion engine and so on. But in order to do that, we need lots of minerals that can only be extracted in certain places or, you know, at the bottom of the ocean. And so ocean, kind of deep sea mining in places like the area really opens up kind of new frontiers for capital accumulation. And I can imagine the state coming in, our system of states and big business to oppose or to quite violently anyone contesting this, because they will say, well, what do you want? Do you want a future based upon carbon capitalism, or do you want a future based upon, you know, so-called clean energies and technologies? And of course, what I would want is something that is quite different to both of those things, that is based upon a greater understanding of how we live as a species with each other and with the planet. And development is about development of people, not about the development of infrastructure, although we do need infrastructure. And so I think that we'll see more and more kind of binary arguments like that. And this kind of quite energetic drive towards the ocean and the blue economy seems to me to be really the final frontier, or the final, perhaps the final kind of breath of capitalism as it kind of collapses under its own contradictions.
Thanks for that. So I think with that, and, you know, if I may also potentially a bit of a bleak outlook, at least in terms of this potential opening up of the final frontier, I think here towards the end, I'd just like to get the both of you to reflect a bit on sort of what needs to be done to challenge this currently dominant outlook of merely thinking in terms of technical fixes in order to facilitate business as usual, right? So earlier we had Alex talking about the need to develop trans-sector solidarity, and this phrase that you also have in the book, saltwater cosmopolitanism. And I think also, Liam, you know, part of what you were getting at here was also that capital at sea, of course, shouldn't be seen in isolation from what's happening on land, right? And so I think that also goes for the types of political struggles that are to be waged if we want to see a different future to the one you are outlining now, for example, with deep sea mining, right? So maybe you could just close with some reflections on, you know, what needs to be done in order to develop these types of trans-sector solidarity to take us in a different direction.
I'll start on just a couple of points. I mean, I think what's quite exciting is the growing recognition precisely for those types of solidarity and precisely for systemic change. And this isn't just coming from typical kind of quarters, it's coming from people like, you know, Earth system scientists who, after studying processes like the Great Acceleration, the Anthropocene, and so on, have recognized that the only way to adjust this kind of death drive that capitalism is putting us into is to change the system and to, you know, to live in greater harmony with nature and each other, and to change the way that we consume and to change the way that we work. And I think that I actually see a real kind of possible alliance with quite a lot of the people who are at the UN Ocean Conference. And what I would ask them to do is to think more critically about the systemic dynamics that they're trying to engage in. Like I say, a lot of the people in this realm are very well-meaning, but they miss perhaps the dynamic of capitalist competition, which essentially will drive us and the oceans into a very difficult kind of world system. Alex, I don't know if you wanted to add anything.
Yeah, I mean, I just to echo what you're saying, I think at one level, there's the age-old need to organize across the whole chain. So what looking at the oceans allows us to do, as I hope we've done today, is think, okay, the ocean is not separate to the social reproduction on land, and the more we connect them, the better. That means, therefore, organizing, as I say, across the whole chain, thinking about the interconnections between Amazon warehouse workers and Filipino seafarers. Now, that's a tall order, but I think it has to be within our imagination to do that. And there, you know, there's occasional instances of that kind of solidarity coming across. I think it is important also then to conceive of labor at sea in many instances. You two in particular have worked very closely on fisheries as being comparable, not necessarily the same, but comparable to other forms of temporary or migrant labor that is about remittances that has, as happened in the Philippines, it was part of a labor exporting strategy for men to see and for women to care, to home caring, child caring, cooking, and so on and so forth. So I think that there is still amongst those of us that are perhaps more land lovers a misconception of the sea as being an exceptional arena of labor, and there's every possibility of thinking across the chain. Two final things that I'd say in relation to this, Mats. One is that I think that there are interesting to me anyhow political considerations, organizing considerations on the left as to the right balance between, if you like, blockage and more strategic aspirations to transforming the very conditions of reproduction. So to put it in plain English, I think that there was a moment of exhilaration when, say, Occupy Oakland managed to combine local activism with some of the seafaring unions in blockading Oakland Port in California. And that's, you know, that's very commendable, and it I think it's full of very positive energies. But it really then doesn't get to the heart of the issue, which is that we do ship 90% of everything around, and that once again, the problems that we've been discussing thus far of deep inequalities, of structural concentration of power and wealth, of the destruction of the planet, operate in the very mundane everyday settings of towns and cities or of rural areas. And one thing that has captured my imagination in terms of the requirements of the structural transformation to address these problems is, for instance, the proposal for a four-day week, 7 days paid, but 4 days of working, which would arguably reduce what we consume, how much we consume, would thin out and reduce the supply chains in the medium to long term that are in many respects so detrimental to the planet and people without, and this is important, without losing the just transition side of things. That is, somehow making sure that we do ship things in vessels that are safe, with labor that is unionized, that is productive, that is well remunerated, that is well trained, that does have shore leave, that does have the possibility with larger crews, for instance, and crew changes of their own four-day week. Imagining that at sea and thinking how it connects to the global reproduction of our planet, I think is the task, tall order, but it's the task that I think those of us like on this call and your audience for TNI have to be constantly thinking about.
You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. This was a conversation between TNI researcher Mads Babiskard and the authors of the book Capitalism and the Sea, The Maritime Factor in the Making of the Modern World, Liam Campling and Alex Kolas. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you for joining us today, and be sure to tune in next time.